Thank you so much, Val, for agreeing to share a little bit of your story with us. So to start, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and at which point in your story do you find yourself now? And by story, we mean your life with epilepsy.
Okay. My first seizure was in March of 1970. I had a grand mal, and at that time, the rural doctor still made house calls. So he was called to the house as I had fallen on a knife and it cut my eye. So it was bleeding quite profusely. So he stitched it up and it wasn't in my eye. It was just on top of my eye, and then settled my parents because they'd had no idea what was going on. And then in May, I had a second grand mal seizure. But it was expected that I would outgrow it once I became an adult, but I didn't. My second seizure was at the top of a set of steep stairs, which I fell down, of course, and wrapped myself around a bed. So I wrecked my back. This time the doctor was called out again. He examined me. I didn't break any bones, but he asked us to come into the clinic the next day. And I was started on phenobarbital. And at that time, my parents kept me quite close to home. And the only place I was pretty well allowed to go out to was my grandmom's. And to attend school. So I had pretty well only two places I could go to at this time. So it was believed you needed to stick something in someone's mouth at this time, so you didn't swallow the tongue. So it led to a lot of people almost having broken fingers. So it was quite common around our house and eventually in my grandma's house to have padded tongue depressors all over the place. Taped to headboards on the beds and, you know, laying around everywhere. During my junior high years, grade 6 to 9, years 69, 70 through 72, 73, I never had a grand mal seizure in school. All of my seizures occurred either at home or at my grandma's. I don't know why that was.
Convenient.
It was convenient. In spring of 73, in grade 9, the GPs finally admitted defeat, but not before they admitted me to the U of A hospital numerous times, not just once, for numerous tests, and one of them being the pneumoencephalography. I remember quite clearly, and I'd never recommend anyone go through it, which is nice because they don't even do it anymore. They just have MRIs. And the test didn't show anything other than the fact there was a scar on my right temple. And they kept telling my mom that I must have been delivered by forceps. Mm-hmm. And she kept saying, no, she wasn't. And they said, well, she had to be. And mom said, I was there, she wasn't. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, wow.
Other than that, didn't show anything. But I did get to make friends with all the doctors and nurses because I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, out for 2 weeks, in for 2 weeks, maybe 1 week, out for two, back in for another week, out for two.
Wow.
So it was fun. I had a lot of fun, a lot of adventures in the hospital, visited other kids on other floors. It was a great time. It was almost like a holiday. I had more fun and I got to go out more in the hospital than I did at home. So that's why it was like a holiday. Since none of the tests showed anything conclusive, I was finally referred to a neurologist in May of 73. Unfortunately, he kept asking what I wanted to study once I started high school next year. And I started out with a surgeon, but he said, you can't do that. Because if you have a seizure while you're having surgery, and I said, okay, that makes sense. I said, well, then I'd like to be a general practitioner. Yeah. And he says, well, you can't do that. You couldn't handle the studying and the hours leading up to it. And so then I had to think of something else. Then finally I said a nurse. And he said, oh, you couldn't handle that. You wouldn't be able to handle the hours and the shift work. So he said, what else would you like to be? And this time it took me a long time to think of something. And finally I said, a stewardess. And he said, policy won't allow you to be. And he said, what else? Well, I never got to answer because my mom finally took me out of the room. But then on the way home, driving up the hill, because his office was situated at the bottom of the hill, I told my mom I wasn't going to high school next year. And she asked me why. And I says, why go to school if I can't do anything? And then eventually they worked out something. My mom and her mom tried to find another neurologist, of course. So they found one that was in the family, of all things. We saw him in July of that year. And mom explained what happened on the last visit and turned to me and he asked what I wanted to do. And I said, the last one asked me that question, knocking down all the answers. So I just said, I don't want to go to high school. So mom interrupted saying, well, she has to. And he said, why? If she really doesn't want to. Well, you just have to. And he says, no, you don't. If she doesn't want to go, don't make her. So eventually we decided over July that I would try correspondence in math and English and go to high school in the fall and just take a couple of fluff courses, two electives in the morning. It meant that I went on the school bus to the high school and mom had to pick me up in the afternoon. So she did a lot of driving that first semester. Second semester, I did take a full caseload, and that was quite a step. I didn't do so good. All my marks were, I just barely passed. But all of high school continued much of the same. I barely passed. And that going from an honor student to barely passing was a big change. And I only graduated because you needed 5 credits in math, and there was no way I could do math. That was one thing that was beyond me. So they introduced in my final year something called Mathematics 13, which was just a review of math in junior high.
Yeah.
And I could do that one because I knew it, and I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have. And then my neurologist wasn't helping me. So in May of 1976, same year I graduated actually, he sent me with a referral letter, obviously, to the Montreal Neurological Hospital.
Okay.
And I spent a week and a half or two there, I'm not sure which. So drugged up, I only remember snippets of my stay there. And eventually I got a diagnosis that my seizures were so generalized that no, I wasn't a candidate for surgery. And they let me go home. So drugged up on a cocktail of medications that, I was pretty well out of it for weeks. But I was glad that I didn't get brain surgery because I saw patients in the ward because it was a room longer than this room. And I saw patients and I saw them before the surgery and I saw them after the surgery. And since brain surgery was in its infancy, no, it was, those patients couldn't even walk and talk afterwards. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that wouldn't have been something I wanted. But unknown to everyone, there were to be consequences of taking that cocktail of drugs. And they manifested 28 years later in 2004. I didn't have seizures for those 28 years, okay, unless there was a change of medication, and I never could have changes in medication. I usually ended up going back to one of the medications that originally I was on, and I'm still on that drug. Every time they try to take me off of it, I have a reaction, or as a result of an allergic reaction, or after I bled out too much after the birth of my son. Attending a school in a small town is a disadvantage, especially a Catholic school, because they're very judgmental. I tried a medication change, and that was the birth of Status Epilepticus in June of 2004.
You had a Status Epilepticus case?
Oh, I've had a couple since then.
Oh, wow, that's dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Scary.
So, and since then, I've also been diagnosed with chronic inflammation of the lungs and various other things like osteopenia and sleep apnea and you name it, I probably got it, type things. Mm-hmm. But all of I've learned to just deal things one day at a time and to continue to look on the bright side, because everything that you go through has a silver lining. And people can't believe that I still have such an upbeat attitude. That's just the way it is. For many years, I could not do anything related to math. Then slowly through the 30 years, I have been able to learn things that I never could before. Might be small to you, but to me, they were like mountains. Then I suddenly could understand things about chemistry and biology that were totally beyond me. I know that every time I learn something, there is a chance that I could lose it all if I have a seizure. I'll also not be able to remember it if I don't do it daily until it becomes routine and it's built into me. My best support was Dr. Starveld. He had the EEA booklets in his office. And when my counselor found out, my counselor was my support after my ex-husband left me. She told me it wasn't enough to just know about them. I actually had to join it. And it was because of her that I actually joined them back in 2005 or thereabouts. And I've never looked back, and they have been my support ever since. My early years going through it at school, and mainly at school, and even into college a little bit, was that I really can't do anything. I was still of that mindset. People didn't let me do anything. My family was dysfunctional. They kept me at home. They wouldn't let me do anything. I was not allowed to take swimming lessons. I did not learn how to drive until I was 22. And that was only because my boyfriend at the time, who became my husband, insisted that I need to, and he made me learn. And because he was making me drive, I decided to get my learners so that he wouldn't get into trouble when he was teaching me to drive. Mm-hmm. And when my parents found that out, they put me in driver's lessons with my brother. So that's how that happened. When I went to college, I did not get to stay on my own or with other people. I got to stay with my grandmother. So I never really got away from family. Mm-hmm. I think maybe when I got married, that was maybe part of my rebelling and wanting to get away from family.
Mm-hmm. So if you had to name, let's say, two or three biggest challenge over the course of the years in your phases of life living with epilepsy, what would you say? So one would be living under overprotection, right? That's probably a big one.
That was a big one.
Well, you said you couldn't drive, and then you learned, so
I
you
learned.
Overcame that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you feel stigma when learned that you had epilepsy?
I heard very often from the kids I went to school, you're sick in the head. Sick in the head. We don't want you on our team. We don't want her on our team. They said that to the teachers numerous times. It was different teachers that they'd say it to, but they still said it. So really, I didn't want to do anything either. So that was another thing that, you know, okay, I'll stay at home. And I stayed at home, stayed away from people, didn't want to really interact with them. I became a person that loved my books. Didn't care for TV, nothing, just loved reading because didn't interact with anyone, nothing bothered me, just was with myself. So, yeah.
So if you were to think back, what was your best support system? You mentioned your family was a little bit overprotective, and for many years you were either family or school or grandma or school. So who would you say made up your support system over the years? I'm assuming your children now are part of that.
My children are part of it now. They are my best support system. My boyfriend, my counselor actually became my friend. She helped get me on age. She said, you have too many problems that were caused, and you have too many injuries that they're not looking at. So we went before a tribunal, and they just looked at me and said, we don't know why you got rejected. This is ridiculous. And we hung around for a while after that, and we still do. So she was a support. And like I said, the Edmonton Epilepsy Association is a big one. Because I know if I have any questions or I want to do something and I feel safe doing it there, that's where I do it. If I have questions, I learned a lot from them, especially when I was reading the book about seniors and epilepsy.
Okay, and if you had to choose the hardest battle related to epilepsy to date, what would you say was that?
The hardest battle would have been when I was diagnosed with blood disorder and the osteopenia and all that stuff. And I was going through a broken clavicle that I lost a 1-inch chunk out of at the time, because I didn't want to leave my kids. I was really scared at that time, and I had no one to talk to. So I talked a lot to myself, especially in the car when I was driving.
Is there something that comes to mind that's related to you having seizures or epilepsy that actually created a great experience?
The one good thing that comes to my mind is when I was in the hospital expecting my third son, and there were strange things happening when they were inducing me, and it triggered petit mal seizures, and they didn't know if they should continue or not, so they called in Dr. Starveld. So that was my first time meeting him. And it was the beginning of my relationship with him. I was so impressed that I kept up my relationship and I went to see him. And it was history after that. So that is my fondest memory. I will never forget where I met him.
You mentioned that over the years, well, since meeting Dr. Starwell, you met the EEA. So what other things can you say that the EEA has impacted your life with epilepsy?
I have learned a lot about epilepsy. I went on a lot of field trips that I never went on when I was a child. Never would have imagined that I ever go on. So I did that. There was a lot of socializing with other people. Other people that were like me. At the same time, it was like imagining, how come my life couldn't have been like that? But, you know, my life was what it was. And it was like, okay, I wasn't born at the right time. You know, I was born in, you know, your infancy, basically.
Is there any final word or message you want to leave our listeners and our members with? What would be something that you have an inner resilience and positivity? So I think that you have it regardless you had epilepsy or anything else. What would you say as a message of hope?
To live each day for itself and to be positive for it. Always greet it with a smile and everybody else, because people might have a bad day, but smiling at them might be the only good thing they have that day. And to strive for whatever you want, because you don't know what you might be able to achieve.